Hello and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we'll be discussing all things episode 4 of the Patricia Rohr series, Killing Field. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Rabia Chatri. Rabia, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing great. Can't complain. Also, we're joined by Jennifer Leahy, a research and investigative assistant. Jen, how's everything going?
Things are great, Tom.
Good. Well, listeners, as you know, this week on Undisclosed, we discussed the crime scene and everything that transpired surrounding the discovery of Joe and baby Alex about 4 months after they disappeared. Before getting into the episode, though, I wanted to do 3 quick hits on things in the news, including a couple touching upon cases that we've either covered or discussed. The first, Rabia, you brought this up in a recent Unfiltered. Rocky Myers, whose case we covered in a series, he was convicted of the murder of his neighbor in Alabama. It was discovered by his legal team that his defense counsel was a high-ranking member of the KKK.
Yep.
And now, Rabia, the judge has set August 25th as the date the state has to reply to the defense filing that Rocky's conviction should be thrown out based upon this KKK discovery. So what are your thoughts in retrospect, in this issue again being litigated?
I mean, you know, look, at this point, I feel like the state should just crawl away in shame and be like, you know what, just let's just get a do-over. We are sorry. This was wrong. The fact that the state is still fighting any of these issues in Rocky's case is egregious, and given this latest kind of revelation about his counsel, I mean, I wonder because I mean, this is the kind of thing I can see the state trying to take this all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, mm-hmm. and I wonder if the court as it is, these justices would be like, well, I mean, just because he was in the KKK doesn't mean he could not duly represent his client. You know what I mean? It doesn't mean he didn't. I mean, I can actually see this play out like that. And it sucks that that's even a possibility, but I think it is.
And then, Rabia, to your point about the current constituency of the Supreme Court, interestingly, we have a case out of Florida. A chiropractor was accused of inappropriately touching his patients, had his license suspended, and then had criminal charges related to continuing to practice medicine after it's suspended. He was given a jury of 6 jurors in Florida and was convicted. He has now appealed, and the Supreme Court agreed to take his case, which is interesting because our Amanda Lewis case, as we've discussed, Amanda, charged with the murder of her daughter and a drowning death, was given the option. You can have a jury of 12 with the death penalty on the table, or you can have a jury of 6 and we'll take the death penalty off the table. And so, Rabia, to your point, how do you think the Supreme Court's going to look at this question of can we have a jury of either under 12 or as little as 6 for a non-capital case?
I mean, for a non-capital case, I mean, I'm actually surprised that they took it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm actually really shocked, because if you have a defendant who has the ability and, you know, without any coercion, understanding fully what's going on, to decide I want a bench trial versus a jury trial,
mm-hmm.
and that same defendant is able to then say, okay, I agree to the 6-person jury trial. Like, why would that be an issue, I guess, is what I'm trying to figure out. Why do you think they took it?
I think Justice Gorsuch is very much an originalist.
Okay.
And
12 it is.
Some are saying an originalist interpretation of the Constitution requires 12 jurors.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so he maybe joins with the more liberal members of the court to hear this. But we'll see. Yeah. It'd be interesting to see how the court rules.
How do you think this is going to affect the Amanda's case?
It won't be retroactive.
Okay.
I wouldn't think. And so I don't think it'll affect her. But for listeners wondering, we are about to file for clemency with Governor DeSantis in Florida in addition to her legal appeal. And so we'll keep you updated on the status of Amanda's case.
Good luck. Okay.
And then finally, sticking with the Supreme Court, Ravi, again, we discussed this. I brought this to one of our Undisclosed Unfiltered episodes recently, the Charles Don Flores case. Ravi, this is the case where the neighbor was hypnotized, her neighbor was murdered, and Penn and Teller, the magicians, wrote the amicus brief to the Supreme Court saying, this is the way we trick dupes in the audience, and essentially this is tricking into a conviction. Supreme Court decided we're not going to take that case, and so Supreme Court will not hear whether hypnosis is per se improper and has no place in the criminal court.
Which means it stays alive in the criminal courts.
All right, so pivoting then from those cases in the news to episode 4 again, Killing Field. I'm going to start with what I think is my biggest question in the case, and I know we raised it in the episode. We have a message on SpeakPipe from a listener, Mimi.
Okay, this was such an interesting episode and so many things to mull over. I have a couple of questions. The first being, do we know for certain what happened? It seems like from the episode, we don't know for certain what, if anything, happened to baby Alex. And I feel like that really, whether or not he was harmed, really changes the profile on the perpetrator. Because why would somebody take the risk of a crying baby, of leaving a crying baby in the woods not that far from a path? Like, why would anyone do that unless it was somebody who had a lot of empathy towards kids, or so just like a normal person, or somebody who had a relation to this baby and wanted the baby to be found? Like somebody who didn't, you know, who didn't think of it as being a risk, but was like, I hope somebody hears this baby so that they can discover Joe dead and the baby alive, you know, and save the baby. If it was somebody that also hurt the baby, then I feel like that changes this to just like a completely insane crime of anger or whatever, or potentially just like a random perpetrator, although it doesn't seem that way because there was no motive for sexual, didn't seem like there was any sexual assault.
And so summing that up, what Mimi was curious about was what we think about whether the killer actually was trying to keep Alex alive in the hope someone would find him. Didn't work out, obviously. And for her, that would very much change the profile of the killer, whether they were trying to keep Alex alive or not. And so, Jen, I'll start with you. From all of your investigation in the case, what is your final thought on it? Do you think the killer was trying to save baby Alex or wasn't trying to save baby Alex?
Oh, man. I mean, if you have a baby that is, you know, that young in, and it's December, you know, like one of the longest nights of the year, it's cold. I mean, I guess I shouldn't say night because we don't know what time all right. This happened, right? So that might influence things. But I mean, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around thinking that like, that anybody would reasonably think that this baby would have a chance of surviving. Mm-hmm. But I mean, maybe there's something psychologically going on, you know, where like, you know, if sadly he did die of exposure, you know, like maybe not wanting to directly be responsible for the infant's death. Right. Even though you are, but yeah. But I can't imagine like you think that there'd be much of a chance. Like you'd have to be willing to run some pretty big risks, right? Like,
yeah, and Robbie, obviously we discussed this in the episode. What is your take? Do you think the killer was trying to save baby Alex, or that wasn't really part of the thought process?
Look, the baby is something that's confusing to a lot of folks, including to the profiler that we're going to be speaking with at length about the crime scene, the manner of these murders, what happened to baby Alex in next week's episode. So I thought it's interesting where our profiler landed on baby Alex, and y'all are just going to have to tune in and listen on Monday.
And the thought that came to me, Jen and Ravia, is if we're looking at Patricia as a suspect, let's assume, sake of argument, the killer was hoping someone would hear or see baby Alex and save him.
Yeah.
We'll discuss going forward. The state tried to connect Patricia to the crime scene, but also her alibi is I'm in North Carolina, not Pennsylvania. And so it strikes me, Rabia, if we do think the killer was trying to keep baby Alex alive in the hope he would be found within a couple of hours, isn't that pretty strong evidence it wouldn't be Patricia because she's trying to, if she's the killer, establish the alibi in North Carolina?
I mean, I think it's a fair argument to make, but I don't think at any point the state argued that the killer did not try to kill the baby. I mean, the state was just like, this is a monster who killed both mother and child. And also remember the autopsy report said it was baby died either of exposure or suffocation. Now that suffocation could be because somebody actually suffocated the baby by pressing their face down into, you know, Joe's stomach, or just because that baby, when it's stuffed into the one of these snowsuits lying face down at 4 months, is not going to be able to turn its head and not be able to breathe. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, is it more likely that Alex died of like exposure? I feel like it's more likely he probably died of like suffocation. And, you know, babies also, we're pretty sure he was given some milk before this happened because his bottle was empty. Babies, ask me how I know now. Like, I got another one like in my house again, but you know, they're always spitting up and throwing up. And so you leave a baby upside down, stuff like that. At some point, if there's any kind of liquids going to come out of his mouth, he could just even smother himself in that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing I'll say is this, if you look at the autopsy report, you know, it's interesting because it describes the baby's thighs as being chubby.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like if the baby still had a significant amount of like kind of baby fat on him, it means that he didn't kind of waste away before dying, which I think exposure would have taken a lot. I think it would have taken longer, but I, you know,
right.
I'm not a professional in any of this, but again, I think either way, the state was like this person deliberately killed both mother and child. And of course that didn't bode well for Patricia, as we're going to get to.
With summer here, we've been planning a 4th of July trip up to New York to see family. And with that comes some significant expenses for us to consider. Luckily, we have Monarch. Monarch is the personal finance app that tracks everything: accounts, investments, savings goals, and spending. Get your first year of Monarch Core for half off, just $50 with promo code undisclosed. With so many plates in the air as a professor with a podcast and pro bono work in the wrongful conviction space, Monarch has taken the mental load of tracking my finances off my plate. I especially enjoy Monarch's Sankey diagram, which is helping to visualize exactly where my money goes each and every month. The great thing about Monarch is that most apps only tell you what you've already spent, but Monarch helps set goals, map out big purchases, and see if you're actually on track all before it's too late to adjust. And maybe my favorite feature is Monarch's bill split, which helps you in those tricky situations when you're splitting bills with other couples. Just scan the receipt, everyone claims what they got, and then settles up, no separate app needed. Use code undisclosed at monarch.com to get your first year of Monarch Core half off at just $50. That's $50 off your first year at monarch.com with code undisclosed. And sticking with the subject of baby Alex, we had a question from Dro Is Him. Can Patricia's defense ask a judge to exhume baby Alex and test his DNA for paternity?
Okay, this is a conversation we have had at length. When I say we, I mean kind of like Team Patricia, including with her lawyer, with her advocate. Yeah, I mean, anybody can ask for anything. I wonder about the probative value of it. Right. So like, let's say that you are able to win that battle, which is going to be really, really hard because you know who's going to be opposing it is Joanne's family, is the baby's father. Right. So let's say you're able to somehow win this battle and exhume the baby. And it turned out the DNA doesn't, you know, match. Now, having said that, also, by the way, you know, a spleen sample was taken from the baby. It's in a lab somewhere. So, or it's in evidence somewhere. So we should actually be able to get DNA evidence out of that. But even if we are able to prove that that baby is not Alex's, I don't think most courts would find that strong enough to overturn the evidence that ultimately convicted Patricia. So I don't know if the effort is worth it, given like what impact it would have in court.
Right. Yeah, I think I'm on the same page of the probative value here is not going to be strong enough to support the exhumation.
Yeah.
One last thing on baby Alex, and this will seg into the clothing that Joe and Alex were wearing when they were found. This is a question by Courtney Brulee. I thought I heard Rabia say baby Alex was in his pajamas. I may be wrong, but in the 90s, I believe it was more common to get babies dressed before going out. I would take my kids out in their footy pajamas all the time when they were babies, but I get the feeling Joe would probably not do this. So I'm wondering if she herself was getting ready to go and then was rushed out of the house before getting a chance to dress the baby. Now, baby Alex, if I recall correctly, had pajamas on and a snowsuit above the pajamas. It was wearing pajamas, not, you know.
And also, by the way, the word pajamas, the reason we use that is because that's how it's reported by a police officer.
Yeah. And so what's your take on that, Rabia, in the sense of would Joe, even with the coat above, have taken baby Alex out in pajamas? Do you find that odd at all?
No, I think we don't even know if it's pajamas. Like everything a baby wears at that stage could be pajamas, really. Like, you know, all the onesies they wear, all the footies they wear, all of that can be pajama wear, but also day wear. I mean, like a 4-month-old baby, rarely are people like, I'm going to put them in a pair of jeans and a button down, right? That's like a special occasion type of thing. Everything a baby wears at that stage, I can absolutely see a police officer, a man who has no idea, just be like, oh, those are pajamas. Right. They all look like pajamas. So I don't really take that. I think Alex is probably wearing what a lot of 4 months old wear, which is like rompers or some kind of a jumper. We don't have, Jen, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't remember seeing any pictures in the crime scene evidence of actually Alex's clothing, though.
Yeah, no, I didn't see any trial exhibits that we have access to.
Yeah. So we don't know ourselves, but I don't think it means much of anything.
Yes, we're less clear on baby Alex's clothes, but we're very clear on Joe's clothes. And so, Jen, I'll start with you. We have a comment by Maureen Diane. I just listened to the first three episodes again because this jumped out at me. How is Andy able to describe what Joe is wearing with so much detail, down to long dangling earrings? I know everyone is different, but he doesn't come across like the type of husband who pays so much attention to his wife's clothes that he'd be able to surmise what she would have worn based upon the clothing left in her closet and jewelry box. And didn't he say she and Alex were playing in bed when he left for work in the morning? Was she playing with the baby in bed fully dressed at 7-ish in the morning before he left for work? What am I missing? And so, Jen, we noted, he says when I left around 7 a.m. for work, they were playing together in bed. And so, Jen, what do you take about Andy accurately describing all the clothes that Joe was wearing when she was found?
Yeah, so I actually remember wondering that too and talking with Rabia about it. And I went back and looked. It's been a bit, but and at least in one of his statements, the way he phrased it was such that she was likely wearing or something along those lines. So I kind of wonder if they had posed that question, like, what might she have been wearing? Or what do you think she might have been wearing? And then he, you know, it wasn't like I saw her, put these clothes on. It sounded like there was a little bit of room for like, this is what she often wore. This is what she likely was wearing. I mean, it's still pretty accurate, but although I think her earrings were not, if I'm correct, I don't think they were dangles. I think they were like a hoop situation.
Okay.
But yeah.
Yeah, but I can see if they're anywhere off the earlobe, a man saying that's dangly to me. I mean, like you got to take all this with a grain of salt.
I don't see much of a distinction between.
Colin's like, what do you mean? the complication with police reports is like all you're getting is what that officer decides to write down. We don't know how the information's been elicited. We don't know how full it is or how incomplete it is. We don't know. I mean, it's not a recording. It's not a transcript, right? So again, it could, I'm sure the officer's like, what do you think she might've been wearing? I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. Now, and hopefully, a husband is able to say, well, this is a jacket she kind of wore every single day. These are the boots she kind of wore every single day.
Right.
Beyond that, I think though he did mention blue jeans, which may be okay. Maybe she wore jeans every day. Maybe that's the kind of girl she was. I don't think he described a sweatshirt though, or what kind of sweatshirt?
No.
Yeah. So, I mean, That's not to say that she couldn't wear, but given the weather, given, like, you know, when winter comes, I got one pair of boots that I wear every single day, even though I own like 50 pairs of shoes, I wear the same ones. And so if he's observant enough, then he knows. And I'm guessing the way she kept her home, she probably kept those boots by the door, you know. So he was used to seeing her in a certain way. Do I think it's suspicious that he knew almost exactly how she's dressed? Maybe. I don't know. Not really.
And Robbie, your point about him maybe not mentioning the sweatshirt, that is going to tie into this connective tissue between these two points of baby Alex and the clothing, which is to say, as we noted in the episode, Joe's jeans are unzipped. Her sweatshirt is pushed up. And as we noted, that allows for skin-to-skin contact with Alex. And we wonder in the episode, could the jeans be connected to that too? But my question, Rabia, is if the sweatshirt is pulled up and the belly is exposed, would they have needed to unzip the jeans at all to have that skin-to-skin contact?
Not necessarily. And this is actually something that comes up in episode 5, next week's episode, with our profiler, who has a compelling theory about why her jeans might have been unzipped. So again, I don't want to jump the gun. Let's just go ahead and wait for that. But
you'll put a pin in that.
Yeah, you put a pin in it. You're not wrong that that wasn't necessary to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And then to plant a seed, and then we'll get to something where a lot of listeners had questions and thoughts. And so this first comment is by Catherine Arvanitis. And Jen, I'll start with you. We discussed this a bit in the episode. Is it possible Joe did not walk to the area where she was found, but instead she was dumped there? And Jen, we kind of talked about the implausibility of it a bit. And I wonder, from your perspective, what is your thought? Any possibility in your mind that they are dumped there as opposed to walked there?
I mean, I think there's always a possibility. It seems like you couldn't get, from what I understand, you couldn't get a regular car, like a regular vehicle, like close up into there. You could, you know, maybe drive into a field, but I feel like in winter, there's just so you'd be leaving tracks, right? First of all, like the chances of you, like, especially if the theory is you're taking her Toyota, you know, like, would it have like the clearance? Like, it just doesn't seem like you'd be able to get very close in a normal vehicle. So then it's like, yeah, you'd be at a huge risk, you know, somehow carrying two bodies, a body and a, you know, it doesn't seem, it's hard to imagine that it would have happened. But I mean, maybe, I guess if you got like a, you know, a four wheeler or some sort of other vehicle that could be going on the path and you knew the area and, you know, maybe you could go out at night. If you'd have to be pretty familiar and know and pretty confident that no one would hear you or see you.
Yeah. And that's going to tie into, again, this theory that seems to have a lot of legs with our listeners. I think, Robbie, more so than any theory we've had since Tap, Tap, Tap in season one of Adnan's Ed. And that is this theory that Joe might have been going to get a Christmas tree and that is what led to her death. And so Special Knives writes, "This case makes me so sad. I think your Christmas tree suggestion very much fits the scenario we see. My initial question before other listener thoughts is, Robbie, would this possibly square at all with the phone call that Andy's mother says she had with Joe? Or would that not make sense given that it seems very much a different plan than the one that Joe would have had with Andy's mother?"
I think they were too. I mean, so Andy says that they were going to go Christmas tree shopping that evening. And this is something, by the way, and I think it's in the episode, in the audio, where Jen brings this up for the first time. And I'm like, wait a minute. Wait just a second. I had noticed it in the statements, but I never really thought it. I didn't really connect any dots there. I just was, okay, there was a good Christmas tree shopping. I mean, I don't think that has anything to do with what the mother-in-law was going to do. I mean, listen, it is December 15th. And, you know, generally speaking, if you look at Joe's, the pictures of her house, and I actually found some more pictures today I hadn't seen sooner, pictures of her house, pictures of her car. She is super orderly. I'm guessing she is very well, like, managed, plans ahead. She is 10 days before Christmas and she still needs a tree and she still has a good gift of gifts. I can totally see her trying to do both, you know? And especially because this was, I think it was like a Wednesday. So I can see that maybe they're like, okay, if we get a tree then this weekend, we can set it up, you know, when he's not working. There is just something about, okay, the tying back to whether or not she was walked in there or could have been dumped there. There is, it's not impossible that she was dumped there. And there are a couple of reasons why. And I have saved that again for next week's episode. We're going to talk about that actually in next week's addendum as to why there's a possibility. What I think is, but I think it's highly unlikely. Let me just leave it at that. I think it's highly unlikely for reasons I'll explain next week's addendum. I'm sorry, guys. I know like half my answers are like that. But you know, the way the episodes are unfolding, I don't want to jump the gun. But I listen, a number of very smart people have said, no, we think she was killed elsewhere and then dumped here. Jennifer already brought up the access issue. It would be really, really hard to get a body out there without, you know, and that field, by the way, that's private property. You'd have to be driving up to somebody on somebody's private property to get close enough to then take her into the woods. The other thing is this, because I was there. I went there. Sarah Kalen and I went to that space. Even going from the field into that patch of woods, around that patch of woods is kind of like, I don't want to call it a trench. I don't know what to call it, but it's kind of like that. Like it dip, like it dips very, it dips. You almost have to walk through like marshy, watery, and then you go back up. So when we were going from the field into that patch of woods, we had to like kind of walk down this little like dip in the earth, like a little trench area. It's all swampy and dirty. And there was actually a little like water running through it, and then walk back up a little bit of an incline to get to the woods. And so going from the field, it doesn't make sense. There is, like I said, a well-used trail that was not far from the bodies. So I think also, and we mentioned this in the episode, the baby's rattle, that one that's shaped like a telephone, and you can see the photo of it on our social media, on our Instagram. That was found halfway at the halfway point between the bodies and the trail. To me, that suggests that she came in on the trail, whether she walked or was carried in, but that that was the access point and not the field.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Yeah, let me ask this before getting back to the Christmas tree theory. And Rabia, we have Doug Brennan saying, is that an intentional circle of rocks for a fire? Looks like it's set up to sit on the down tree and enjoy a warm fire. And Rabia, we noted in the episode there was a small campfire within that clearing. And so what can you tell listeners about this campfire and what that might tell us?
Yeah, about Doug, that was an intentional circle of rock. That is exactly the campfire that we were referencing. And the thing about that campfire is that according to the farmer, Kovalchik, Paul Kovalchik, who found the bodies, that's why he went in to investigate when he saw like a bunch, he saw something in the woods. And he's like, man, these kids are always out here. They're lighting a fire at this little campfire. They drink and they leave their trash. They leave mail. I don't know why people dump in their mail in there. But it was a place that people would hang out there. Like kids would hang out. Others would hang out. You know, there are hunters in the area. So it was kind of like a ready-made little fire pit, you know, people could use over and over again. And it was not far from the bodies.
And then Jen, in terms of this Christmas tree theory, we had multiple comments by listeners. Sue McCormick regarding the Christmas tree theory, assuming the plan would be to cut a tree down, could the back of an axe be the murder weapon? Shannon French, I was wondering the same. It seems like they might have an axe or saw of some type to cut down a tree. Could that be the murder weapon? Jen, what is your take? We discussed the injuries to Joe in this episode and the lack of a murder weapon that was found for Andy or anyone else, you know, other than the gun. What's your take, Jen, on this theory of maybe an axe being the murder weapon if this Christmas tree theory has legs?
Yeah, I would love actually like a pathologist or, you know, to weigh in on the, I don't feel qualified to weigh in on the scalp wounds and the skull wounds to say what exactly could cause it. But it seems like, you know, potentially. I'm trying to remember. I feel like when we cut down trees as a kid, this was a long, long time ago, but I feel like we used a saw. But, you know, it could vary depending on the place or, yeah. Yeah, regardless, I mean, either one is going to be, you know, it's going to have a heavy end to it, most likely.
And Jen, in terms of a pathologist reviewing this or Rabia, we noted in the episode there was so much force, there were fracture lines in Joe's skull. And I wonder whether that, does that require a person of a certain weight and strength to be able to cause that amount of damage and injury?
Yeah. Well, I want to first go back to what you talked about in terms of the potential weapon. I mean, we know it's not a saw because it wasn't, they were not saw-like cuts. Could it be the back of an axe? I guess the question is, if somebody's carrying an axe, why are they going to use the back of it to attack her versus the front of it? I don't know. Might it be? Yeah, the back of an axe can certainly cause a blunt force trauma, but so can the butt of a gun if it is wielded by somebody who's strong enough to make those injuries. And, you know, given, again, we talk in depth about like what the crime scene says to expert eyes in next week's episode, but we have to think about not just like the strength of the person to make those like 19 really, really devastating injuries, but also their endurance. You could be winded. Now, it could be in a moment like that. They say if you have enough, you know, like adrenaline in the right moment, a person can lift a car, right? Like, you know, so it could just be the adrenaline is pumping hard enough that maybe it doesn't take somebody that is so big. But it does seem like it does take a certain amount of strength. And also, it doesn't seem like she had a chance to fight back at all.
Yeah. I'm really curious as we wrap up this Christmas tree discussion about both your thoughts on this. I'm going to play a second SpeakPipe message. This one is from Liz.
Hi there. My name is Liz, and I just finished the latest episode in the Patricia Rohr case. And I am a native of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and towards the end of your podcast this week, you started working on the theory that perhaps there was some conversation about Christmas trees, Christmas tree farm, let's go get our Christmas tree. And as a native, not only of the Lehigh Valley, but of Bethlehem, the only reason that someone from Bethlehem would have business in Slatington, quite honestly, is a Christmas tree farm. So I'm not sure. I took a quick look to see where those locations might have been in 1994. I remember as a kid, we used to go to this place called Beck's. And so I would highly encourage that as a theory. I remember this case. I was in high school. I remember discussing it with my mother. So I appreciate you guys, your work, and I'm going to keep listening. Thank you.
And so Robbie and Jen, this is from listener Liz. She was in high school at the time of this murder. She lived in Bethlehem, which is very close to Catasauqua. And she says the only reason someone in Bethlehem would have business in Slatington was to go to a Christmas tree farm. The place I went there was called Beck's. And so her theory is this is really the only reason why Joe and Alex would be in this area where they were found is to go Christmas tree shopping. And so, Jen, what are your thoughts hearing from Liz that this is the only reason someone in this general area would be going up to Slatington?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I remember looking just out of curiosity. I may have them pinned on the map somewhere. I'm like, I wonder if there were actual Christmas tree farms in the area, you know? And it sounds like there were, and I feel like I ran across some as well. But so, you know, potentially maybe that would, it sounds like that might be give some like a logical explanation for traveling in that general direction, right?
And Robbie, what are your thoughts in terms of this listener in the area in high school at the time saying this is the only reason that I would be there and presumably that they would be there?
I mean, the thing is that, you know, according to Andy, Joe did not know the area at all. He could have taken her, I don't know, anywhere and been like, there's a Christmas tree farm here, right? I don't know. Or maybe Andy didn't want to go to a Christmas tree farm. And he was heading that direction. And suddenly he's seized with murderous rage. It's hard to know, but this is very interesting that there's a place called Beck's that that Liz remembers from that time. We're going to get further into this, but there are a couple people linked to this case that also owned some nurseries and farms out there that, and I wonder if their connection is to this place or not. We'll look into it. Thanks, Liz.
Moving from the place where the bodies were found to timing, for me, had sort of alarm bells in my head. And we mentioned a bit in the episode when it says that Joe's watch is frozen at time at 3:50 p.m. And of course, one deduction we could make from this is absent Joe already having a broken watch, which I don't think is that realistic. Does that suggest that she is killed or at least very physically assaulted at around 3:50 p.m., which explains why the watch is stopped at this particular time? And so, Jen, am I reaching too much and thinking 3:50 p.m. is a very significant timestamp in this case?
From what I saw in other documents in the files, they had a watch expert look at it, and they thought the watch had stopped due to, like, either, you know, like exposure to the elements or the battery running out or whatever. So they didn't think it was like a single moment of damage that likely stopped it. So okay. I'm not sure how much it tells us. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And we shared a picture of the watch again on our social media. The watch doesn't look damaged at all. And you know, it would be like something out of a novel where, like, you know, if it was actually broken and it stopped exactly the time of the murder, I mean, wouldn't that be like tying something to a nice little knot? Unfortunately, I think the battery just ran out. It just stopped working for other reasons, or the elements, you know, because the watch had no damage at all.
Yeah. The other question I have, and I really hope this is in the file, I'm guessing it's not because we didn't mention it, and that is that green beans and corn are found in Joe's stomach.
Yeah.
And my question is, was Andy ever asked, did you have green beans and corn for dinner the night before? Do you have leftovers? Is that anywhere in the file?
Not that I have seen, no.
Okay.
No.
Jen, you're not aware of that being in the file at all?
No, I wish that they asked that, or at least that if they did ask it, that they had documented their response. I think I remember reading or hearing somewhere that Joanne had been eating more vegetarian lately. Yeah. But yeah, no, I didn't see anything specifically about that. It does definitely seem like more of a lunch or dinner food, though.
Yeah. Out of curiosity, Jen, is there more to that in terms of her eating more vegetarian? Was she having health issues, or do we know why she was turning to a more vegetarian diet?
I think, but don't quote me on this. I feel like it might have been because there were allusions to her, like, wanting to, you know, maybe get back into, like, shape.
She was trying to lose weight.
That sort of thing. Yeah.
She was absolutely trying to lose weight. She had already lost some weight. And when she met up with those friends just a few days before all this happened, she showed them pictures and she said, look, you know, I've lost, I don't know, 15 pounds. She had lost a bunch of weight since the baby was born. She was trying to get back to, you know, her pre-pregnancy weight. I will say this is also interesting. The we didn't talk about this, but the autopsy report says that the jeans that Joe was wearing closed in the male fashion. I guess men's jeans button opposite the way that women's jeans button. I did not know this. So, Colin, when you button your jeans, is the hole on the right side or the left side?
The left.
Okay. For us, for me, my jeans, the hole is on the right.
Well, I mean, I think it is. Wait, I use my left hand, but I think it's on the right. I don't know. I should know this. My dad is Levi's salesman.
At the time I came across, I did look it up, and there is a difference between how men and women's jeans, like which way they close. I did not know this. I don't know why this exists, but it is. So it was interesting that this one noted. So, you know, was she wearing like maybe Andy's jeans, or maybe she, you know, had outgrown her jeans and didn't want to like buy? And I totally get that too. Did not want to buy like women's jeans and bigger sizes, and just was like, I'll get by with my husband's jeans or something. I don't know. Somebody else, you know, looking at this had, and this is from a long time ago, had said, well, could that suggest that she had been held somewhere for a while and then was wearing that, you know, that whoever held or maybe made her wear those clothes? I think that's unlikely, but I don't know. It was interesting because, you know, Andy never mentions that mm-hmm. she might be wearing my jeans.
And then from the clothes and the jeans, we note that she had $200 bills
yeah.
in her pocket, suggesting she was indeed going shopping. And we discuss, Rabia, why we think this was not a robbery, but yet the purse, her purse, was missing.
Yeah.
And so, Rabia, why do you think this murderer took the purse but not other items from the crime scene?
I think if you imagine a scenario in which Joe is taken outside this patch of woods and says, we're just going to go pick out a tree. Come on, sweetie. And she gets out of the car and she picks up the baby. She doesn't take the carrier. She just picks him up in her arms because it's kind of easier than taking an entire carrier into the woods. And she's got, and there's a trail, so she has a place to walk on. And she's got her diaper bag with her because all moms always grab a diaper bag. She might have just been like, I don't need to take my purse. I'm just leaving the car. It's, you know, it's right here. I'm just going into the woods. It could very much easily fit into the scenario that she just left her purse in the car because she thought she was going into the woods to point at a tree and tell her husband to buy it. And if that's what happened, then the person who had the car afterwards might not have even realized until later, like when they cleaned it. Because remember, there's no fingerprints in the car.
Right.
Like, oh, my God, the purse is here. And then they got rid of it.
Yeah. And Jen, what's your take? Are you sort of on the same page as Rabia in terms of the purse being missing? Or do you have your own thoughts and theory?
Yeah, no, I actually have been wondering that myself. And I think Rabia just sort of gave me that. Like her explanation seems like it makes a lot of sense because I, you know, it's either that or whoever murdered her for some reason needed the contents of the purse for something that was not robbery based, you know, but like for some other reason. But it seems like the leaving it behind in the car because your hands are full with between holding your baby and a diaper bag, that does seem like the most logical.
It could also be that she took the purse with her and she had the car keys in the purse. Mm-hmm. And so the person like, I got to grab the purse so I can get the car keys instead of standing there and rifling through it. Remember, somebody might have wanted to just get in and out of there. Nobody's going to want to hang out there because it was not that remote of a place. So I think that's another possibility. But yeah, I don't know. But I don't think the fact that the purse is missing also has anything to do with whether or not it's a robbery. I don't think that means it's a robbery. The purse, according to Andy, would have had her checkbook. Her bank account was undisturbed. The police were monitoring it. Nobody was cutting her checks. We don't know if anybody would have used the credit cards because he literally canceled them 2 days later. So, you know, and if the only cash he had on her was not even in the purse, then I don't know. The only thing of value the purse might have had was keys.
Yeah. One thing that we've covered a great deal from day one on Undisclosed is the problems with expert witnesses for the prosecution in so many cases. And here, Rabia, in great detail, you review the testimony by forensic entomologist Dr. Casey Kim. You speak to Dr. David Rivers. And essentially, the conclusion is the work that Dr. Kim did does not meet the current scientific standard. They use weather from Chicago instead of the area where this happened, et cetera. Rabia, do you think, is your sense in speaking to Dr. Rivers that we need to review all of these cases where entomology evidence was important back in the 90s and aughts, or that this Dr. Kim, for whatever reason, was just an outlier who was terrible at their job?
You know what's odd about that whole thing is that it's not even that Dr. Rivers is saying that the analysis done then is not up to par now. He's saying it wasn't even up to par then.
Right. That was my take.
Yeah. And he felt, you know, kind of hesitant to say it because this is obviously a colleague in his field, but he was kind of flummoxed. He's like, I do not understand how and why and where he got like, you know, his how he reasoned through all this, like why he thought it was okay to do the analysis the way he did it. You know, look, at the end of the day, does it make a huge difference in trying to figure out what happened to Andy and Joe on December 15th? Not hugely. I mean, shifting the whole thing by a month seems significant, but all that means is that according to Dr. Kim, the bodies were there at the latest by February, mid-February of that year, whereas Dr. Rivers say, no, they were there at the latest by mid-March. Nobody is able to say that they were definitely there since December, right? So that's the thing. And if somebody could tell us that, or if somebody could tell us, oh, they haven't been here for more than 2 weeks, then you'd have a data point that could be helpful. Otherwise, it's not hugely significant, but it does bring into question, like, I mean, you have to understand, like, this is somebody getting on the stand. They're testifying in front of a jury. The CSI effect is happening. All the jury is seeing is like this, that the state has all this scientific evidence. It's all scientific. It all connects somehow, right? Even if I don't exactly understand the significance of it, there's a scientist telling me the bodies were there for that long. Because the thing is, like, you know, for the state, what the state's trying to do is they're trying to convict Patricia Rohr. They're making the case that those bodies were out there for a long time. They were there since December. Not that Patty made a second trip and dropped the bodies off later.
Right.
So the longer that time period they can establish, better for them. Maybe that had something to do with the analysis that Dr. Kim gave them.
Yeah, and Rabia, on that point, we noted in the episode, Joe's hand, her left hand, the fingertips, mummified. And we might get to this later, so feel free to put a pin in this now if you don't want to answer. But Susan Deitch asks, so much info, let's talk about mummified and what conditions are necessary for that. I know that dryness is one factor. This may be a clue to where their bodies were for 4 months. Rabia, any insight now, or is this going to come later, about what would lead to a mummified left hand?
Yeah, I don't even know because there is just so much to review in this case. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we're ever going to get to that specific issue, because the mummification stood out at me as well, that the baby had, the hand was mummified, parts of Joe's face were mummified. Mummification existed in both of these victims. And we brought that up to the experts in the Burgess group. And just like was said here by the listener, then, yeah, you need like certain kind of dry conditions have to exist for the mummification. Whereas Dr. Rivers was like, well, they were probably covered by 6 inches of snow most of this time.
Yeah.
It's a little hard to understand, to be honest. Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, we did consider very strongly that they might have been in a different place. In fact, there was even a place that we thought I mentioned this, I think it's first or second episode, the sub-cellar. Sarah Caitlin and I went down into the sub-cellar of their house and looked around. And while we're in there, we're speaking to one of the experts and we're like, well, it's like dark, but there is some air because there's particles floating around. It's cool. Bodies could be preserved here for a long time because that's what it was used for. But again, it goes back to you have to decide, like, what is a more likely theory? Were they killed somewhere else and moved, or were they walked in? And I think we're going to break that down further next week.
Yeah. And previewing that last topic for today, we had a comment, and I'll start, Jen, with you. Our comment is by Jessica Rodriguez. I'm confused by there being no wounds to her arms or hands when her hand is broken. Did the autopsy report say there were no defensive wounds? Wouldn't the baby have injuries if mom was carrying him when she was attacked? Also, isn't just as likely the mom walked into the woods without resisting because she was threatened with the gun that was used to kill her? And so, Jen, what is your take in terms of this description of no wounds to the arms and hands of Joe in this case?
Yeah, so there is one, right? Is that, if I'm remembering correctly?
The hand
is there not?
It's not a hand. It's not a hand. It's just one finger.
Just one finger
on the hand being broken. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And then I think on one of her shins, if I'm remembering correctly, there's also a potential. Is that right, Rabia?
I think there's some bruising on the right shin, on one of the shins, yeah.
Yeah, but not like extensive, I guess, defensive wounds, no.
No.
So
it doesn't look like there was a cat fight. Nobody, you know, somebody had to grab her by the hair, or she was, I mean, it just feels, the crime scene looks like there wasn't even a scuffle. Mm-hmm. It just looks like she didn't have a chance at all to fight back, or that she even tried to fight. And also, there's no evidence of her having tried to run.
Right.
Either.
Yeah. And then, so the one question I have with that, we might get to this down the road, but as you say, Rabia, there's not much of a sign of a struggle, but we mentioned these fingernail pieces, including one that's with a raggedy edge. And so, I mean, to me at least, if I'm just sort of thinking it through, a fingernail with a raggedy edge would make me think of a scuffle and grabbing and a violent altercation. But what are your thoughts, Rabia? Or is this something we'll get to going forward?
No, we're definitely going to go into the forensics, like in all the different, you know, the fingernails. There's going to be hair, a lot of hair involved. But, you know, the raggedy part of that fingernail is the front of it. Mm-hmm. Was the front of the fingernail. So if somebody during altercation, their fingernail broke, you might think the back part of it's raggedy. But mm-hmm. what we understand is that the front part is not clean. Mm-hmm. It's not a manicured fingernail tip. And Jo kept her nails manicured. And that's one thing for sure. We know that these were not, there's two pieces, I think, these are not Jo's nails. So somebody out there with raggedy fingernails who did not get their nails done left those fingernails on Joe.
Got it. All right. Well, I think that takes care then of addendum number 4. Robbie, you've already previewed it a bit. Can you please follow up and let the listeners know what we can expect in episode 5 of the Patricia Roar series?
Yeah. At the end of episode 4, you heard a little bit of audio of Dr. Sasha Reed. She is an expert in so many different fields, but one of them is profiling and serial offenses. And so next week, you're going to hear kind of the entire profile that she created, and we're going to be talking through it and walking through it. And after that is when we finally start to pivot, because we'll be midway through the season, and we'll pivot to how the case turns to Patricia Roar.
Great. Thanks so much, Jen. As always, thanks for joining us. Rabia, thanks for joining us. And listeners, we will see you back next Monday for episode 5 of The State versus Patricia Roar.
Thank you, Colin.
Thanks, Colin.
Jen.
Thanks, Rabia.
Bye, guys. As we all know, there is always more to the story. So tune in every Thursday during this entire season, where we're going to be dropping our addendum episodes. In those episodes, we will go deeper on some of the issues raised in that week's episode, and we're going to answer listener questions. And if you want even more undisclosed content, remember, you can become a patron by signing up at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And if you've got feedback for us, you can find us at speakpipe.com/undisclosed, where you can leave us an actual voice note. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at Undisclosed Pod. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Pod. And we've got our own little private Facebook group called the Toward Justice Community. All you got to do is answer 3 quick questions and I will let you in. You can follow me, Rabia, on Instagram at Rabia2, the number 2. And you can follow Colin at Evidence Prof on X and Blue Sky. Follow the podcast on X at Undisclosed Pod. We want to thank our sponsors, and I want to thank our intrepid team, our sound editor, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Delhan, and my amazing investigator, Jennifer Leahy. And a very special thank you to true crime author and advocate, Tammy Mall, who made this season possible. Thank you, Tammy, for all your work.